playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Last week may have been explosive on the Brexit front. This week saw the inevitable schlepping backwards and forwards between Brussels and London, and Prime Minister Theresa May isn't out of the woods yet. So, if you're still confused, here's the Gavin Jennings Ladybird Guide.
Another day, another Brexit document. Last week it was the withdrawal agreement, this week it's the political declaration. A recap. Britain will leave the European Union next March. The terms of how they'll leave are set out in a withdrawal agreement, a 585-page legally binding document which includes a continuing customs union between the EU and the UK and even closer ties between the North and the EU that will stay in place unless and until a future deal is done which still keeps the border open between North and South here. The agreement is yet to be put to the European Parliament and the House of Commons in London. If it's not passed and there is no deal, it's not clear how goods and services will move between the UK and the EU. The political declaration, which was published yesterday, sets out what both sides want in their future relationship after Britain has left. It's 26 pages, is not legally binding, and says that both sides will consider developing technologies to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland.
Everything you ever wanted to know about Brexit, but were afraid to ask, from yesterday's Morning Ireland. Over on the Today Show, Sean O'Rourke was slugging it out with prominent Brexiteer John Redwood.
So I wish you wouldn't scaremonger. I think it's totally irresponsible of people to threaten people's jobs and lives, saying that there's going to be some kind of economic blockade mounted by an angry France.
Well, that's your phrase. I'm just simply saying that
That's what you're implying. You're saying that they're going to deliberately mess up what is a perfectly good trade for them where they sell more to
No, I'm simply raising the question.
But I think it is quite a slur on France to suggest that's going to be their aim. And I don't suppose you get any French representative to come on and say that's what they want to do.
No, I don't wish to cast any slur on France or anybody else. I'm just simply saying that
the
situation...
Well, that's the implication of your line of questioning.
That's your implication from what I'm asking you. But in any event, if it is such a painless prospect that would await a no-deal exit for Britain, how come Mrs. May, the Prime Minister, hasn't woken up to this fact?
Well, I think she's wrong, and that's why I'm opposing her on this, along with about 80 other Conservative MPs. Anyway, very nice to talk to you. I hope you understand it soon.
So does that mean you don't want to talk to me anymore this morning? Oh, he's gone. Well, in that case, I think we'd better take a break.
Oh dear, Brexiteer John Redwood having a mini hissy for himself. Not to be put off, Sean took up the discussion again with political journalists Alison O'Connor and David Davenpower.
Alison, what do you make of the latest developments and also Theresa May's plans to get this deal through the Commons?
Look, Sean, if I'm perfectly honest, what I'd like to do is go to a darkened room, lie down with an eye mask and emerge when it's all over.
That's what she says the British public want. They just want to get on with it.
You know, I mean, listening to John Redwood on with you earlier and the way he flounced out reminded me of having a toddler in a high chair who decides they don't want their puree and they fling it against the wall. Then listening to Fintan O'Toole, his book, and explaining the psychology behind it, you're not comforted in any way. And to me, like, ultimately, this is all, this phrase that was used, magical thinking, which I think was an EU official some time ago saying that a lot of magical thinking would have to, even if an agreement has been come to, and you've all this constructive ambiguity, and even if they go and they all have their meeting this weekend and agreement is reached, you just have this sense that it won't be worth the paper it's written on, even if it's called an agreement and everybody comes out afterwards and says there are so many things that have been kicked down the road, whether it's customs, security, fisheries, future trade. It feels like it's just going to go on forever.
David, Fintan O'Toole was describing the withdrawal agreement and all that goes with it as a triumph for Irish diplomacy, but is it not a bit like the DeLorean car? It looks fantastic, but isn't going to go very far.
It's a triumph for Irish diplomacy. It's certainly a great success. It would be a little bit of a worry to see technical solutions back in there. In the statement yesterday, I don't think the Irish officials would be pleased to see that, even though it's obviously aspirational. But look, I think the fight back is on now from Theresa May. Obviously, she's a very limited number of cabinet members who are rooting for this. But below the cabinet, which she has Amber Rudd now, below the cabinet she has people like Mel Stride and Rory Stewart, who are putting forward a very compelling case, because the thing about the Redwoods of this world is they do not have an alternative deal. It seems to me that's the strongest point.
But they have a very simple approach. Let's just go. We'll leave leave our borders open to stuff coming in and people from France, we'll just trade under WTO rules. What's your problem?
But whatever about John Redwood, I think most Brexiteers realise that that would be a catastrophe. I mean, nobody sensible is saying blithely, well, let's just trade under WTO rules. If that happens, it's a big problem for us. But it seems to me that it's a very dangerous game that's being played, because the talk is that it goes to a vote. The vote goes against Theresa May, maybe by a narrower margin than we might expect, but it goes against her. And then the markets tank, sterling collapses, all the rest of it, and there's a second Commons vote and people come to their senses. That seems to be the talk, but that is a very, very high-risk strategy indeed.
From Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. The sporting week began with a sensational win over the All Blacks last Saturday night, but as one Irish rugby team lit up Lansdowne Road, the lights went out on Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane's tenure in soccer, and already the race is on to appoint another manager.
You're through to the voicemail of John 360,000 a year Delaney, Chief Executive for Life of the FAI.
John, me old mucker, Mick here. Some nights we had, eh? You, me, the prawn sandwich brigade, boys of the old brigade. Look, I'm clearly the most qualified man for the job because I'm Irish and currently unemployed. Ha! Typical Paddy in England, eh? I'd love another crack at the lads, or any lads. So yeah, John, call me. I'll be at this number for the next hour.
Hello, it is Mick O'Hare, Mick O'Dwyer here, Jan. Look, I heard you have a vacancy going for management at Bannisdore. Look, it doesn't matter what sort of a ball it is. My coaching is the same for whatever sport it is. Just make them do laps, up and down, up and down. And sure, look, I'll only take my expenses, Jan, you know. I'll do it for the love of the game, for the love of the game. Give us a ring in Waterville, good man.
Whose answering machine is that? You know who it is, Jan. Yeah, don't have a lot to do now at the minute, thanks to you. Thanks to your mutual agreement. Mutual? Just let's say, you know, we're looking out, John, waiting in the long grass. Because the grass isn't cut properly in the FAI anyway. That's why it's always so long. I'll be waiting there for you. Eyeballing, John, from a distance. Like a sniper's distance.
From Callan's kicks last night. Well, Ryan Tuberty has been running a very sweet competition all week in collaboration with An Post. It was all about the letter you wish you'd sent. And as you can imagine, it tapped into a rich seam of really moving and powerful memories. Claire O'Sullivan from Waterford wrote in to Ryan.
I'm going to be 40 next week. And I think when there's milestones and you start thinking and you start thinking about the people who won't be there and who will be there. And grief is a funny thing. And I suppose you don't think of these things initially. And then afterwards, you kind of, you do have regrets. And I'm not one for regrets. And when I heard what you said, it was actually the only thing that came to mind immediately is what I hadn't said.
To
my dad. He passed away a year and a half ago.
I'm sorry, dear. What happened to him?
I got a call from my sister to say that he thought he had had a stroke and that he was on his way to Bantry Hospital. And so I just threw stuff in a bag, you know, 2.5 hour journey. And I got a phone call half an hour later to say, get here as quick as you can, we've got an hour. Because he had had an aneurysm in his brain and not a stroke. But we got there in time and he held on to all his six kids and my mum were there and everything. And it was unreal. It's funny how you just go into autopilot and things like that. But you know, he was a fantastic father, and I suppose at the time we just couldn't bear to see him suffer. And you know, we just said, you know, Dad, we're fine. You know, you've done what you could for us, and just go. You know, but then you regret what you haven't said, and that's what the letter is about.
Claire's father spent his entire life doing jobs for his six children, being at their beck and call. And while we all say thanks for the big stuff, it's the little things, always. And that's why Claire says she found it cathartic to write the letter.
And it has helped immensely, you know.
Has it really?
Yeah, it has, yeah. I think we grieved as a family, but this is personal. Mm-hmm. You know, this is my story.
And it says, to my beloved dad, I forgot to tell you something. As I held your hand and felt your pulse slowly fade, I told you to go, that it was okay, that we'd be fine. In my shock and grief, as you slipped from this life to the next, I forgot to say thank you. For never saying you were too tired as I climbed on your lap every evening, the second you came in from a long day of work. For telling everyone to mind their own business when they said I was too old to suck my thumb. For letting me stay off school when I had my heart broken at 16. for not telling me what career to choose or what to do with my life, even when you thought I was daft, for not saying a word when I told you I was pregnant and I'd be doing it on my own, for driving me to hospital as you'd done with Mam all those years before, for sitting with me on the morning of my wedding and having tea and brown bread while everyone was losing their heads in the madness around us. These are a snippet of the love and kindnesses you showed to me, but the small ones that stand out. For being the constant in my life, I was angry that you'd been taken too soon, but now I realise some people would love just a day with a dad as good as mine. Thank you for loving your children and your grandchildren with every fibre of your being, forever in our hearts. Lots of love always, Claire. That's a beautiful letter, Claire.
Thanks. It's hard to hear it back.
Why?
It's just so part. It's just my heart on a page, I suppose, you know. And, you know, people say time is a great healer. You know, I suppose it's not. It just puts things into perspective. It doesn't heal.
Well, the winner of the €5,000 prize was announced yesterday.
Claire, good morning to you.
Hi, Ryan.
Are you well this morning?
I'm very well. I'm inside the hairdresser with a half a head of highlights on, so I'm having my 40th party tonight.
It's tonight your 40th party?
Well, it's next Friday, but there's a little thing called the toy show on, and I've got little kitties, and we can't miss the toy show, so Mammy had to move her birthday party to tonight instead.
Well, my God, I cannot believe. A head half full of highlights, a birthday party change for the toy show. I mean, you're just my ideal woman. You're amazing. I've got so many letters from women and girls to their dads, and this one was just a beaut. So, Claire, you are our overall winner this week. You're going to win €5,000 worth of One
God,
for All cards
so much.
From
On Post. He's still looking after me up above. He's still minding me.
Is that you're going to give him the credit for that?
Yeah. Okay. You and my dad.
Yeah.
Well, and Grace.
And Grace, yeah. Well, she's amazing. That's why they called her that. Goodbye
Thank
for
you.
Now. Bye, Claire.
Take care.
Happy
Bye.
Birthday.
Thank you.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show yesterday. It's 8 months now since Ireland rugby players Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding were acquitted on all counts of rape and other charges following a trial in Belfast which lasted 9 weeks, attracted world media attention and repulsed the country. This week, the preliminary report into how such cases should be conducted by the criminal justice system in Northern Ireland was published. Retired judge Sir John Gillan has made more than 200 recommendations and has called for a radical overhaul of the system. He spoke with Mary Wilson.
I was a barrister for, 29 years. I was a judge for 18 years. One of the most harrowing experiences of my entire legal career was meeting the complainants in this case. And also, I might say, meeting a number of the accused and their families. But particularly with the complainants, it was genuinely harrowing. I spent an hour and a half to 2 hours with, I think, probably all of the complainants. And I got fresh insights into the consequences of serious sexual offences in a way that I never had before.
And did they impress on you that they feel put on trial, that they feel that they are the ones that are in the dock and not the accused person during the course of a trial, and ask you to come up with recommendations to address that?
Virtually without exception. That was a theme that coursed through virtually all of the meetings I had with complainants, and they felt that they were people on trial. I met some who had dropped out of the process. As you know, 41% of people who actually come into the criminal justice system drop out. I met people who had not gone forward to into the criminal justice system. And those recent figures in England suggest that 83% of people who are subject to serious sexual offences don't go into the criminal justice system. And I urge everyone to go into the criminal justice system. Perpetrators should not be allowed to escape. But equally, I have to say that I fully understood the reasons that they put forward for not so doing.
For complainants, what can you do for them to make this a less traumatic experience?
The 220 recommendations I've made are part of a jigsaw. And you can't select a handful out of them and say, well, that'll improve things. Nothing will improve their experience unless we look at the overall picture. For example, compelling complainants, and for that matter, accused persons as well, to go through the humiliation of relating the intimate personal details of what happened in these sexual encounters where the complainants are alleging that their bodily integrity was violated. Going through that before a public gallery of maybe over 100 people, doesn't matter that there may be special measures or they're screened off. They know that these people are there listening to them. And indeed, at least 50% of them will be men listening, of uncertain ages, listening to this. I'm a strong believer in open justice, but open justice only applies if it is in the interest of justice and it doesn't provide an impediment to justice. What on earth can the benefit be in making people go through this humiliation in front of a packed public gallery?
Retired Judge Sir John Gillan heard on Tuesday's Drive Time. How rape trials are prosecuted in the Republic also came under the spotlight in the Central Criminal Court in Dublin on Monday, when Leona O'Callaghan waived her right to anonymity so that her rapist, Patrick O'Dea, could be named publicly. He was jailed for 17 years for raping and assaulting Leona when she was only 13. She's now 37, and in her graphic, powerful victim impact statement, she faced down her attacker in the courtroom by detailing the devastating effect his actions had on her head and her heart. But she told him, and I quote, "Let me be clear, you did not win." Leona appeared on the Clareburn Live television show last Monday night alongside Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan.
Well, I suffered an awful lot of self-hatred. I hated myself for a long, long time. And the parts that were harder for me actually was the times when I didn't say no, when I didn't fight back, and when I just zoned out and just, you know, I suppose when you've been held down, you learn very quickly not to struggle back because it makes it harder. And so I stopped struggling back and I stopped saying no. And I had to do a lot of work, as you say, and a lot of soul digging to tell myself as an adult now not to look back with the brain of an adult and to imagine the brain of a child and know how afraid I was back then. And to forgive myself, I suppose, for not doing more, because you do blame yourself enough. And that's what I'm saying, is the process is hard enough. There's so much self-blame. To have somebody else stand up and make you feel like, to me, it's one step away from saying, sure, that wasn't as bad then. Mm. When in fact at times it was worse. No more, just like, the, you know, saying that the person had gone out and what was their intention in wearing that underwear. It's one step away from saying she was asking for it. It's one step away. It's unethical, it's immoral, and there's just no need of it. And it should be, there should be some sort of, I suppose, oversight there. And I call on you, I suppose, Minister, to...
Yeah, I don't accept that there's such a thing as a non-violent rape. And I want to point to the 17 Act, which is just coming into force now, which defines for the first time the matter of consent, or indeed defines quite clearly what isn't consent, and where it speaks of assuring that there is agreement to a particular act, and that agreement is given freely and voluntarily.
Leona O'Callaghan with Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan on Clareburn Live, an exchange which was replayed on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. The director of the Rape Crisis Centre, Nolene Blackwell, was listening to that, and she gave her reaction to Audrey Carvel.
Nolene Blackwell, what do you make of that interaction between the two, Leona O'Callaghan's points?
Yeah, she's absolutely right. And so is the minister, actually, in saying that last year, for the first time, we put into our legislation the fact that if the sexual intercourse is not free and consensual, it is rape, and that consent is about freedom and voluntary giving of that consent. And I think what she highlighted in her case, and also it ties into what Judge Gillan is finding in Northern Ireland, is how much of a mindset change is needed in our general public, but also in our legal system, in our judicial system, in our trial system, so that people understand that anything that is not free and voluntary consent is not consent at all. That all of the things that have been talked about in recent weeks, women's clothing, failure to shout no, that none of these things are what the act of rape is about. Rape happens when sexual intercourse happens without free and voluntary consent. And in order for us to understand that, as Judge Gillan has said in his review out today, the judiciary, the legal system, need to understand the myth that we all have in our own heads.
Yes.
Jurors need to understand them. And so Minister Flanagan has this great opportunity coming up now. He has a review ongoing. He has said he wants things to change for victims.
From Tuesday's Morning Ireland. The sudden death of Sandy Harsh, presenter of RTE's Country Time, caused huge shock and sadness among her many fans. RTE's head of Radio 1, Tom Maguire, said Sandy had an encyclopedic knowledge and a tremendous love of country music and Americana, and her anecdotes and stories gave new life to the playlist she chose for every show. Well, John Creedon also paid tribute to Sandy on his show on Tuesday night.
Came as a shock to most people, really. Sandy was born in the States, Rhode Island, but spent most of her life, about 50 years of it, here in Ireland, mostly in Dublin. And with Sandy, it was always about the music, whether it was working as a photojournalist. She worked a lot with record companies and with Hot Press over the years, and also on RTE Radio 1. And there was always that very distinctive, youthful voice. A lot of people thought Sandy was like in her 20s or 30s, but no, she'd been around a while, all right, had Sandy Harsh, but she had a huge knowledge of music, and not just country music, particularly country music, American folk music, but the whole thing, soul, blues, country, you name it. And I remember first meeting Sandy when I was living and working in Dublin 25 years ago, or maybe even more. And when I moved back to Cork, she would still stay in touch. There would be the occasional package with a CD in it, or a tip-off about some lesser-known country music singer-songwriter who was touring and visiting Ireland and playing Whelans or something. And I have to say that over the years, she never ever gave me a bum steer. When it came to music, she knew what she was talking about, and she knew who was who and what was what. In fact, strange coincidence, today as I got that call from Dublin, I had on my desk a big box set of folk music that Sandy had sent me, I'd say a full 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, and it never quite fitted on the shelf because it was just a big box. There was a bunch of CDs inside in it, everything from Billy Bragg to Liza Carthy, Julie Felix, Bob Dylan, all of that. And it was strange to see it there on my desk today, complete with the post-it, the little stick-on little yellow label that she affixed to that box about 20 years ago, or more maybe, and a little note saying, I'm not sure what you're playing at the moment, but you might. I actually tweeted that earlier on today. Strange coincidence. But speaking of Bob Dylan, she once told us of a road trip that she made in the company of Bob Dylan. She spent about 5 hours, I was going to say 5 years, but I think that's what it felt like. She said the crack, it wasn't up to much really. But she did spend a lot of time in and around music. And as I said, spent 5 hours in the car with Bob Dylan. So her love goes out to all of those who knew her best, particularly to Sandy's sister and to her two daughters. I think we should just remember Sandy's tonight with a song from the man with whom she shared the car there for 5 hours. This is Bob Dylan.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay.
Remembering Sandy Harsh, and may she rest in peace. The impact of homelessness on our children is something that schools are struggling with right across the country. Principal Enda McGorman and Homeschool Liaison Officer Yvonne Kiley are at the coalface. They spoke with Evelyn O'Rourke about the daily challenge these vulnerable families face.
Just want to say, boys and girls, what wonderful listening we had this morning at our assembly. So well done to everybody. And I think, teacher, as a treat, did we just get...
It's a growing concern for me and for school principals. We're really, really worried about the effect that homelessness and the homeless crisis is having on children in school.
So you've pupils here today who, you know, once they leave this school are going home to temporary accommodation, mm-hmm. in all its guises, hotels, B&Bs, hubs, whatever. Mm.
Yeah. And it's at the basic level. One family that we were trying to support, their B&B was in town, so to get transport out here, the children had to be on a bus so early that the breakfast bar wasn't open for them, so they were come to school hungry. I'm just thinking, in the last month, I've written 3 letters for families to say, I know this family, they're a good, solid family, please afford them the opportunity to rent your house. You never thought you'd be doing that as a school principal, to try and, you know, support people who you've known and whose children you've known. I guess these are some of the realities that we're dealing with that we never thought we'd be dealing with. Another concern we would have is homework, and how can I do my homework if I'm lying on the floor and they're wonderful children. They're resilient, they're smart. And I guess school is the time when they can forget that they're homeless. Ultimately, we have to try and give children back their childhood. And if school is the place that we do that, then that's the work that we have to do.
So I've visited parents in temporary accommodation. So I've been in those hotel rooms, tiny little B&Bs with their belongings scattered around, and seen firsthand how these children are living. There was one family I dealt with. They were in accommodation close enough to the school, but at the weekends then when the hotels got busy, they'd be moved out of this hotel and were put on a hotel at the side of a motorway. They were told not to come down at normal time for breakfast, and the parents are doing all they can. It's the simple little things, you know. It's heartbreaking.
From Evelyn O'Rourke's report for Thursday's Today programme. Well, these days, Dr. Tom Clonan is best known to RTE radio listeners as a security expert, analysing the twists and turns of global conflicts. He's also known for his activism on disability rights issues and as a whistleblower from his time as an Irish Army captain. In fact, his latest role as a principal dancer in the acclaimed production of Soldier Still came about when the producers of the Junk Ensemble Dance Company read his book, Blood, Sweat and Tears. It details his personal experience of violence and trauma while serving with the Irish troops in Lebanon in the mid-90s. Tom Clonan was Ryan Tuberty's guest on Tuesday.
It culminated in one particular massacre in a village called Quanna, where 117 people were killed on the one day and hundreds, like, really badly injured. And Irish troops with no medical training moving amongst them, you know, trying to give comfort where they could. And 24 hours later, I was walking up Grafton Street.
How did that happen?
Italian adjutant Alton Edge from Dublin, he said to me, I've good news for you. He came to me over the Motorola. He says, you're going home tomorrow. And I went back. I was like literally 24 hours walking up Grafton Street. So you bury the experience.
So you were one day in the middle of all that.
And we had had 3 weeks of it. On the last night, I took off my combats, which were just filthy, put them into a barrel, poured diesel on them, set them on fire, burnt all the letters that my mum had sent me, all the little St. Christopher medals and the prayers, because I was just sick and I'd really had enough, and everything I believed in just disappeared.
Why did you burn your mother's letters?
Because I couldn't bear to read. It was like almost like an exorcism, just burning everything, burning the clothes, washed myself with a bottle of water, got on the coastal highway down to Beirut, got on the flight, came home, and I never spoke about it. But I suppose the culmination of it, though, Ryan, and this is the thing about trauma, that it revisits everybody. I went out to Lebanon in October 95 with 220 other guys. I never came home. The person who came home was a completely different person.
Tom Clonan heard on The Ryan Tuberty Show. It's hard to believe it's 6 years now since the celebrated Sunday Times war correspondent Marie Colvin was killed by the Assad regime in the besieged town of Homs in Syria. She was fearless by reputation and took many risks to get her story in conflict zones like Lebanon, Kosovo, Afghanistan and in Sri Lanka, where she lost the sight in her left eye. Apparently, her personal life was as complicated as her professional life, a war zone, as her friend Lindsay Hilsum of Channel 4 told Sean O'Rourke. She's just written a book about Marie. It's called In Extremis.
You considered going, I know, with Marie into the besieged town of Homs on what was to be her last story. Now, why didn't you?
Because it was beyond my danger threshold. It involved being smuggled over the border. It was when the revolution was turning into war, and various of our colleagues had gone in and had left because it was so dangerous. Rockets were coming in every few minutes. And I actually didn't know this, but it would involve, for Marie and her photographer, Paul Conroy, walking for more than a kilometre bent over through a storm drain, and it was just too dangerous. But Marie, we had dinner in Beirut, and she said, anyway, she said, it's what we do. She was determined to go.
But you write that you were angry with her when she returned to Homs a second time with photographer Paul Conroy.
Well, that's right, because what happened was she got in and she got an extraordinary story. The Syrian government was saying that only terrorists were in this enclave, but Marie found terrified women and children, and she wrote an extraordinary story for the Sunday Times about the widow's basement where they were sheltering. And then she had to come out to file that because the rebels had said, go, it's too dangerous. But she felt she had abandoned the people of Homs, and so she and Paul went back in. And that was a fateful decision. And she called me, and I was actually angry with her. I said, Marie, you know, you've done the story, why go back? She said, Lindsay, it's the worst we've ever seen. I said, but what is your exit strategy? She was calling me on Skype on the satellite phone. She said, well, that's just it. We don't have one. I'm working on it now. And a few hours later, she was killed by a rocket fired by President Bashar al-Assad's army. They were targeting them. They were targeting the media center. And in fact, her sister, Kat, has now brought out a court case, a civil case in America against the Syrian government for Marie's extrajudicial killing.
How did you hear the news of her death?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, I woke up feeling very bad that morning, thinking about Marie. And then I was on the bus and I had a message from a Spanish journalist friend whose husband was also there saying, you know, I think something terrible has happened to your friend Marie. And I suppose that's really the reason that I wrote the biography, was because I wasn't Marie's best friend. If I was her best friend, I couldn't have written it. I would have been too close. I was in her outer circle. But because I had spent that time with her before she went in, and because I had spoken to her just before she was killed, I was very haunted by her death. And the tragic and violent nature of Marie's death has made her more famous than she was. But in some ways, I wanted to bring her back to life and to go into all of the extraordinary life she led, and also, you know, remind people that she was fun. She was the best company on the road. She wasn't just a tragic death. Yeah, she was so much more than that.
Lindsay Hilsum on the life and death of war correspondent Marie Colvin, heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Well, there are only 3 days left to visit the World War I sculpture of the Haunting Soldier. The 6-foot-high installation, made from scrap metal, represents a battle-weary soldier and will be on display in St Stephen's Green in Dublin until Monday. The red paint, which vandals splashed all over it, has now been cleaned up, thanks to the OPW. Sabina Purcell, who brought the sculpture to Dublin, spoke with Joe Duffy on the live line.
Joe Oliver, this woman owns the sculpture. When you were talking to her, Sabina, like, have you any idea why she commissioned it? Because it's a private piece of work.
Yes.
It's not going anywhere
she's
publicly.
She's a writer. And okay. What happened was she heard the story, maybe a folklore story, of a World War I soldier coming back to the land that he worked on, that he lived on. And she decided that she would commission a sculpture in his image. And she wanted this sculpture to be mystical. So those of your listeners who go to see it, you can see through it so that it's mystical in nature. But she was keen that it would be no soldier, no army, all army, no country and any country.
Looking at it, it's an incredible piece.
It's the work. It took them 3 months to do it. Chris Hannam and Martin Galbahi in the forge. And the amazing thing, Joe, has been, it's a cross-generational sculpture. There were school children, there's older people, there's middle people, there's teenagers. And that's been the very satisfying thing about it. And we have to remember that what was done last night does not reflect us.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy on Thursday. Colm Tobin's latest book, Mad, Bad, Dangerous to Know, casts a steely eye on the kind of relationship three of Ireland's most famous writers, Wilde, Joyce and Yeats, had with their fathers. Colm was Sean O'Rourke's guest on Monday.
Now, take us to John Butler Yeats, father of W.B. Yeats, a disappointed husband.
Look, he could never finish a painting. He was meant to be a barrister and he could have gone on to be a judge. He was a great speaker, but he decided he wanted to be an artist. The only thing he couldn't do really was the art. His studio was a marvellous place for talking. His wife was in a permanent rage with him because there was no money. He had these four very talented children, all went to work very early in their lives. And then in a marvellous moment, when he was 68 years old, his daughter was going to New York. People had raised money for him to go to Italy, and he said he'd like to go to New York too. At the age of 68, on arrival in New York, he said, I'm never going home, I'm staying here. And they said, well, you have no money, you know, you don't know anyone here. He said, I don't care, I'm not going home. And he lived for another 15 years in a boarding house in New York. He loved the boarding house because people hadn't heard his stories. New people would come who hadn't heard his stories. He wrote wonderful letters to his son, but then he found there was a woman in London that he had been in love with, called Rosa Butt, the daughter of Isaac Butt, and he wrote her 200 letters. And the agreement was that she would burn his letters and he would burn hers. She didn't burn his. She kept them. And they're in a library in Oxford. And they're lecherous. I mean, they're lecherous letters written by this old man in New York, wandering the streets, thinking about her bosoms and if they were married, what they would be doing just now. And I mean, they're absolutely marvellous. And even when he's like 80, he has, if we could only, maybe
and
now
are they
be
coherent
the time.
Or are they the ramblings of a lecherous old man?
Fully coherent, really good. Like the 1916 rebellion happens and his analysis of American response response to it. He says some very, very funny things. He says that a lot of men die of their wives, but millions of women die of their husbands.
And he spent, was it 10 years working on a self-portrait?
Yeah, John Quinn, the American lawyer, commissioned a self-portrait just to give him something to do. So he worked on it for 11 years, and even at his death, it still wasn't finished. And he would write letters about it, how marvellous it was going to be, how close it was being to finish. And it became a great excuse not to come back to Ireland, because he said, the light in Ireland is different and will ruin the painting. I have to stay here until it's finished. And he had it in the room in the boarding house. He would scrape it off when he got it good, when it was working well, start it again, and then he would walk the streets, and he talked to everybody, and he just had a wonderful, I mean, it's a lesson to us all. Age 68, off to New York on your own in a boarding house.
You never know.
Colm Tobin with Sean O'Rourke on Monday. Well, these days, countless migrating birds are wintering across Ireland in search of milder climes and a good source of food. Derek Mooney went out to North Bull Island in Dublin to have a closer look and to meet Anthony McGeehan. He's the author of The Ends of the Earth, Ireland's Place in Bird Migration.
Ireland's birds are absolutely magical, and we get a fantastic chunk of birds from the Northern Hemisphere, some from Canada, some from Greenland, some from always from Siberia. And the whole lot basically head south at this time of the year, the autumn time. And at the same time as they go around the oceans, up come the southern seabirds, and they track around our part of the globe as well. So it's possible to sort of expect the seabirds from, you know, as far west as Canada, as far east as Siberia, and from as far south as Cape Horn. It's the story of all of that. I mean, most of the northern hemisphere basically cools for the winter time, so all the winged inhabitants have to sort of up sticks and disappear south. Mm-hmm. So they do that, and they find their winter quarters with unerring accuracy. They know exactly where they're going, sometimes to this precisely the same bush they were in the year before, and then they all come back in the spring. So this vast movement involving millions upon millions of birds, it's not chaos, it's totally organized. And these things, some of which will be no heavier than a ballpoint pen, they've got all the information they need to complete those journeys somewhere inside their head.
Fascinating stuff from Mooney Goes Wild last Monday night. Over on the News at One on Tuesday, Áine Lawler spoke with a 77-year-old great-grandmother, Vera Dwyer. Vera was diagnosed with a fatal lung disease 30 years ago and was confined to bed with very poor prospects. That is, until she got a single lung transplant in the UK, which saved her life. At a ceremony in the Mater Hospital, Vera was awarded a gold medallion from the Irish Heart and Lung Transplant Association to mark the 30th anniversary.
It's hectic up here today. This is all a surprise to me. I didn't know anything was going on. I was coming up to the clinic, supposed to be, and when I walked in, there's cameras everywhere. So it is exciting. And they presented me with a medal, a gold medallion.
And what's that gold medallion for, Vera? Tell
us. I am 30 years and 6 months with a single lung transplant. The longest living in the world.
That's some achievement, Vera.
Isn't it just?
Isn't it just?
Isn't it? Isn't it? And I have a kidney 9 years. And I'm just after having a hip replacement 8 weeks ago.
Do you know what, Vera? You're 77 and I have a feeling you're only getting going. You'll be replacing parts and keeping yourself going for a while yet, won't you?
Oh, the new parts are wearing out the old ones now. It's like the care.
And Vera, it's such a fantastic thing, and obviously the same operation has made such a difference to so many people since. You had to go to London, of course,
because
the procedure wasn't available here back in 1988.
No. But the matter that was looking after me before my transplant, Dr. Kyo, and he transferred me to London. Sir Maggie Jacob is world-renowned. He that did the operation for me. So I was so lucky.
And you were so lucky, Vera, because tell us how sick you were before you had your transplant.
Well, I couldn't leave the bed. I was on oxygen 24 hours. Even to wash my teeth, I had to have the oxygen on me. And it was very hard to eat because I couldn't do without the oxygen. So it was pretty bad now, really.
Oh, you poor pet. And tell us what life's been like since.
Oh, I have a new lease of life. What I've achieved is I saw my children growing up and that I'd see them reared.
Oh, Vera, aren't you a lucky woman?
Oh, I'm so lucky. I am really, really lucky. The only thing is I lost my husband that isn't here to see all this. And he was the man that came with me to the clinics and to the hairdressers and everywhere. So that's my only downfall, really.
From the News at One on Tuesday. Well, nobody wants to spend their life stuck in traffic jams on the M50 motorway around Dublin. But as Evelyn O'Rourke found out, part of the problem with the M50 is down to old-fashioned rubberneckers. She joined Sean O'Rourke in studio last Monday to discuss the problem.
Evelyn, rubbernecking, people stopping or slowing down to look at incidents, a big problem.
It is a big problem. And Sean, I saw one that day. We were watching the clear-up of a collision and a man on the opposite side of the road stopped his car to look. Now, I understand the human instinct, you know, we're all nosy. But sitting there, it was actually striking
to see. With no regard for his own safety.
All the cars pulling up behind him as he just stood there and out with the phones and people are videoing and taking photographs. So the driver behaviour, the reactions to the collisions on the M50, these are all part of the problems. And the team say, look, it's really, really difficult. So we met up with one of the operators there, Joe Dwyer. He describes the impact a collision has on waiting times. And we'll also hear from Kevin O'Rourke, who's the head of network operations.
So we have a single vehicle collision in the M7 southbound, just at the flyover at the Red Cow. This is only a two-lane road, so you'll have rubberneckers.
Is that constantly a feature that people are going to stop and have a look?
Every time.
They see blue flashing lights.
Blue flashing lights, it's like red to a bull, everyone stops, has a look.
Look, we can see people slowing down, having a good look to see what's happening.
Occasionally we get another collision happening behind the queue, so it's not a good thing.
Kevin, so we're sitting here looking at this bank of screens. Roughly, at peak time, you could have 1,600 cars per lane.
Per hour. If we get an incident that causes a traffic delay for half an hour, that's 800 vehicles are held up. That's 8 kilometres.
And you see it building up on the screen.
You'll see that red line growing on your Google Maps. It takes hours to clear.
But you will see it now on your southbound side. This southbound side was absolutely jammed solid. Yeah? Not 10 minutes ago. The traffic's moving freely.
So we're now northbound heading towards the collision. But across the way, the car's coming towards us southbound. It looks like the traffic is flowing.
The reason the traffic's moving freely between the crash and here is because everyone slows down for the crash. Look.
It's not like suddenly there's less traffic there. It's just that they've stopped to have a look.
Yeah.
James MacDonald there from the M50 support unit, ending Evelyn O'Rourke's report from Monday's Today Show. Well, far away from the madding crowd and the M50, on last night's Seascapes, Michael Lawless spoke with Roger O'Reilly about his new book, Lighthouses of Ireland.
Beeves Rock is an interesting lighthouse in the middle of the Shannon estuary. Because it's built on a rock that's submerged at high tide, there is only a certain amount of days that they could work on it. It looks like a house with a rocket coming through the roof, basically. Our ex-Taoiseach, Enda Kenny, his grandfather, was one of the light keepers on the rock, and shortly after he took the position up, he got married. There's no room for a family to live on this lighthouse. So his wife lived on the mainland, and he lived for his tenure on the lighthouse. And the only way they could communicate was by semaphore. So it was kind of an early 19th century version of texting, where they would send messages across to each other until he got his leave and then could come on shore.
Michael Lawless reporting for Seascapes last night. But I leave you now with a song from the Beatles, which Ryan Tuberty played to mark the release of the White Album 50 years ago. Guramaga Vasragoluther, Tasulagam Gurwanshiv, Salt Tasaglor, August Gameshiv Lum, Taka Anamakena, and Sachtin Shahagin, Gajishin, Gajeshiv Slan.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life.